You are listening to KKUP Cupertino 91.5 FM. It's time for the Vibrational Voyage program. Good evening. Wow, what a week we have had. Just amazing what we've been seeing going through. As I promised, I brought along some new material related to the equinox. We have an amazing equinox event that's going to happen this weekend. First of all, if you've been watching the moon, you see it's building up towards a full moon. Well, we're going to have a full moon with the equinox, actually Saturday. So it'll be about, just a little bit more than 24 hours before the exact time of the equinox. But close enough. The full moon will still be very full at the time of the equinox. And that full moon will move over and join Saturn. So at the time of the equinox, the exact time, which is 4:20 p.m. on Sunday, Pacific time, we will have the sun will be aligned with Uranus, which is one of the really striking things about this event. But the moon will be with Saturn. And the moon will be highlighting the last Saturn-Jupiter opposition. And so there's discussion about the significance of these events. And so I won't delay. We'll get right into this recording. I did an interview last night with Tiger Windwalker. You've heard him before here many times. He's a poet and astrologer and a pretty astute observer of what's going on in the correlation between celestial events and events on the Earth. And he and I have been having experiences and discussions about these events for a very long time, and we've been anticipating that this time frame would be pretty strong and pretty significant, pretty intense in terms of the events. And isn't it amazing that within minutes, actually a couple of hours to be exact, of the time of this very big event, Uranus moved back into Aries. It'll be in Aries for the next 7 years. Well, it hasn't been there for 84 years, and it was right at that time frame when this earthquake occurred. As horrible as the results have been, this is the kind of result that we can expect. One of the things that Uranus can do is it will trigger surprising, even shocking events, and that's part of the story that we have going on here. But it's only a part. There's a lot more going on here, and there's a lot more that we can actually do. I want to let you know also that there'll be a free event this weekend that I'm facilitating on Sunday. You're welcome to come. It's going to be over at the Divine Science Community Center, and we're going to do a little ceremony and a workshop related to the events of the equinox, the celestial events. And it should be a lot of fun. If you're inclined to want to do a communal thing for the equinox and you want to learn about how the particularities of this series of celestial alignments will unfold, and we'll take a look at things that are coming up leading us towards the December 21st, 2012 alignment, which is actually a really beautiful celestial alignment. So we'll take a look at that as well. You're welcome to come join. I have limited space, though, so I don't know how many people are intending to come at this point. So if you're planning to come, let me know. Send me an email or give me a call, you're welcome to call here at the station tonight, or go to the website and get my phone number and call me. All right, I think we're all set, so here we go. Thanks for joining in. Thanks for being here tonight for the Vibrational Voyage.
What's happening with the equinox and that whole, how that is the doorway that we're moving through presently, you know, and it's gonna be, amplified through this week and the coming
weeks.
Well,
for sure, bro. And the deal was, the first thing I saw was that it's a Scorpio rising chart. If you take that for the chart of the new spring year, what we have is the moon in the 11th house. It's interesting. Saturn's in the 10th house. The moon is in the 11th house in Libra. So you can see, you can really feel the movement of the public opinion, the groundswell, and the importance of partnership with the moon in the 11th house in Libra. That says it all. And we've got the Scorpio rising, you know, so the issues of death and spirituality and power and truth are all really magnified. And not only that, we've got Neptune squaring the ascendant. So we're continually bumping up against the Neptune squaring the ascendant in Scorpio brings up issues of death and power and regenerative abilities, and also of misuse and deception. So those are all really important aspects that are there that we have to acknowledge.
And there's that position of the moon with Saturn, and so that to me the moon is highlighting this. It's not the last exact opposition of Saturn and Jupiter yet. It's coming. It's coming quickly. But the moon is marking that. First, it kind of marks the equinox because the full moon is the day before on this Saturday. But then it highlights Saturn and Saturn's opposition with Jupiter.
I see that, yes.
So to me, that's really a lot about, here we are at the midpoint of our Jupiter-Saturn journey. It's a 20-year journey. And we have Jupiter and Saturn kind of working with each other. And to me, Jupiter and Saturn is very much like related to the expression of culture, you know, the adventure of our current state of karma, the way that gets launched. Saturn and Jupiter come together, and then Jupiter launches out on a 20-year circle and comes back around and catches up with Saturn again. There's two things about that Saturn. Saturn this summer, which I only saw when I was looking tonight to... after you had mentioned some of the new charts that you had seen, the new events that you'd seen coming. So I looked at Saturn, because I've been aware that Saturn's going to meet up with Spica, the bright star in Virgo, which is also known as the gift of the goddess, that bright star. Well, Saturn's about to meet up with Spica. And what's happening in the meantime is there's going to be a comet that's going to come through this summer, and it will go through the sky more or less aligned with the ecliptic and with Saturn's position along the ecliptic. So the comet's basically, from our line of sight, is going to sweep past Saturn, pointing directly at Spica as Saturn is making an approach to Spica. And this just really hit me that what this is resonant with, at least on one level, is that there is a path toward the blessing, the gift of the goddess. There is a path toward that. Saturn, to me, is speaking about a discipline and a path, a way of experiencing, a way of acting, a way of moving ourselves. And it's, to me, it's highlighting that we absolutely have the opportunity right now to fully recognize our relationship with the goddess, with the universe, with the earth, with each other, And that what's happening with this equinox is a herald of that immense potential. The Sun and Uranus conjunction that's happening at the equinox, nearly exact at the time. It could only happen only once in 84 years. It's the most frequent it could occur. And that's happening. So it really kind of hit me that there is something so incredibly beautiful in the potential of what's happening right now. And to me, it seems very resonant. You know, there's this kind of a reflection of things falling apart. And that's kind of that other side of Pluto. It's that regenerative springtime. And spring happens without us making it happen. It's the greatest miracle in our universe, in our world, for certain. And it happens without one bit of effort on our part. It just happens. And we get to see it, and we rejoice in it. Maybe we don't pay attention to it as much as we could, but it's right there. It's in the midst of our experience. So it seems to be celebratory as well. There's this vibration of blooming and birthing and a recognition, or perhaps even a realization. I think that Sun-Uranus element is very much has this vibe of discovery, inner discovery, realization. So I know you probably have some of your own feelings and thoughts about that.
Well, I just think it's the beginning of the Aquarian Age. All the other stuff was just like the, you know, the hoopla. But this is the beginning of the Aquarian Age. It's happening right there on this spring equinox, right within 30 minutes of being exact.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and right in the middle of really significant challenges. So we have to pull things together out of the tumult of it all, and the ebb and flow, the spasming, the catharsis, you know, the destruction, the angst, the turmoil, the social turmoil. We have to pull something together out of all of this that makes sense and sets a new tone and a new direction for the human race.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, you know, it's one thing to have the revolution in Egypt. To me, was really resonant with a wonderful nonviolent way. Now, the thing wasn't about shoot 'em up and guns and the two sides batting their heads together like in Libya now. That's degenerated into that. This was predominantly a nonviolent approach that brought all kinds of people together in their determination, opening up their fifth chakras of being able to communicate and express themselves after being basically suppressed for 30-something years. And it ended up in a way that I'm sure Gandhi and Martin Luther King would have smiled that. And so I think that first instance was also a bellwether for what we can look toward as a best, highest expression of utilizing the energy. I think the fact that it was the first one says a lot. There was no buildup, except you might say Tunisia was. But this was it so much galvanized the consciousness of the planet. At the foot of the pyramids, a place where the most ancient civilized knowledge is the repository for the most ancient knowledge of civilization and beyond. I just think that was so wonderful. Now, the thing is that when you look at all of these aspects and these energies, you have to understand that there are many levels to them. And we never quite know whether a situation will involve more suppression on one end and more obfuscation and lying, or if it will be a situation where a revelation occurs, somewhat like WikiLeaks. We've had WikiLeaks in the last year. We've had WikiLeaks. And that's really the kind of ultimate whistleblowing. We use the government's own papers to see, their own documents to see how shiftless and willing they are to deceive and to dissemble and to lie, But we never quite know. We never quite know if it's going to be a systemic breakdown and you find that lying Republicans who never even mentioned what their game plan was in Wisconsin and suddenly start ramrodding these proposals down the throats of everybody there that's going to take away their collective bargaining rights. And, we don't know how that's going to come back and haunt them. Recall is in motion in just several months. In several months, the recall elections can occur, and those guys who perpetrated a silent conspiracy upon the electorate of Wisconsin will be yanked out of their positions, and there'll be some immediate feedback there. But see, like, we never know, because at the same time, you have the governor there who's sending out police, using Gestapo-like tactics to send out police and to round up the missing senators who've basically gone on boycott. You see these different facets, these different faces show up. They don't always show up at exactly the same time or in exactly the same measure. But it's interesting to see. And then, of course, suddenly, a major cataclysm occurs that reflects the movement and instability of the Earth's crust, the plate action. And then you have a whole new drama that shows up, where not only do you have the government, and the Japanese system is perhaps one of the most capable governmental systems, most modern in the world.
Terence McKenna, he said so much about the acceleration of things, and certainly things that fall into the category of novelty. And he also was somebody very big on harmonics, and he felt that that in particular the nuclear weapons that were used in the Second World War in Japan by the United States government were a very, very significant... the way he expressed it, as I recall, is that that had a harmonic. It was a harmonic of the Big Bang. And although we're not quite at the nodal, the final node, which he predicted would be in December solstice of 2012, here we have something that's very resonant with that. It's actually happening in Japan. And it's another devastating event that has a radiological source. So there's a resonance, and that's part of what we're dealing here with too, that we have these compound resonances through our experience. And I think that may well be a key. I don't want to kind of get off too far off kilter here, but I think recognizing these resonances and these patterns may well serve as a key for us to begin to become conscious of what's really going on. That there's much more happening here. It's not all of everything that's just been created since Ronald Reagan was in office. It's a pattern and a set of harmonics that stretch back over millennia and throughout perhaps even millions and billions of years, not just in human experience, not just in human consciousness, but in the consciousness of everything. So I know that gets big very fast, but there seems to be resonances and patterns that are going on here, and that's what we talk about a lot in astrology as well. So we have some amazing connections and resonances going on here,
And I mention that just because to me it seems, and I think McKenna was pointing in this direction as well, that if we really recognize those patterns, then we can begin to work with them in a more aware and intelligent way.
Well, for sure. And what by time July 1st rolls around here, a little bit after the summer solstice, we will have every major outlying planet involved and interacting with each other at one time. Either through oppositions, squares, or sextiles. Everyone, well, we got to even have a trine there too. But what happens is that when you have basically the whole scene occupied with dynamic energy and movement, stressing and also accommodating, facilitating, challenging, and every department of life is involved in the play and the interplay of these forces, that becomes noteworthy. I don't think that it doesn't happen that often that you get all of the outer planets involved, and from Saturn on out, you get all of them involved in the mix, in the interplay. That would be an astrological crescendo, to say the least. And making sense of that, I mean, I can look at it. I can see it symbolically. I can see it archetypally. I can also see it just in the collision of many, many different essential qualities playing out on the ultimate stage and theater of society and civilization, and where our technology and where all the choices that we have made in the last 100 years brings us to the place of making an evaluation of the fitness of our civilizing imperative, so to speak. Actually, I think it takes it back even farther than that. Because the way things are going now with the dislocations and major cataclysms on the planet is that I think a lot of the topic for this year is going to be how to face death. I think a lot of the folks in Japan maybe had just a few seconds to face their own death. And those of us who clean up the mess, we have to face it too as we confront it, as we see it. There's a very powerful opportunity for us to ask the questions about the important questions about life and how ephemeral it is and just how we place ourselves into the structure of the meaning of life, how we answer that question, what is the meaning of life and death, and how we can find a measure for that.
It definitely shows us where our weaknesses are when we're up against such titanic forces. I mean, we design things for 60 miles an hour, some of our buildings are designed to withstand, you know, up to a 7 magnitude or even a little higher earthquake. I mean, we can comprehend some of these things. But when they start to move out of the range of our engineering imagination, and especially when the money gets in the way, we are not at all well equipped. We're not prepared. I mean, in something you were alluding to earlier, the Japanese were very well prepared. But there are some things, even with the very best focus, you cannot prepare for it with your intellect alone. As a matter of fact, your intellect may well be your undoing. There's a greater range of experience. There's a greater range of resources. There are tools that are not yet used, not yet recognized, not yet practiced with, that can help us. I think part of the situation is here, we are being forced, and we need to be forced, to start to experience things that take us beyond our comfort zone and our capability, our perceived capability. And perhaps those kinds of challenges, if they aren't so dire that they kill us, they may be the catalyst as well for us discovering a whole new potential about the life of our world, the life of ourselves as humanity. I mean, it's either that or we begin to succumb to our own destruction, our own self-made destruction.
Well, you get down to it, and an analysis like that ultimately comes down to what your hierarchy of values are, what you find most important, and to allow the world's population to just balloon up to 6.7 billion without anybody, you know, without anybody engaging in a dialogue or a conversation about it. And of course, if you do, you have major religions saying, no, you can't really do that because, you know, that's taking a life. So many religions would have us continue without any contraception whatsoever, continue to fill the planet. So there's a disconnect there. There's a disconnect there. And I think it's important that we take a look at some of the values and the standards that we have, and we'll be forced to look at those things to see if there isn't another way that things can't be handled. We want to have a quality of life, then we have to look at the population and being able to limit the population on the planet. If we can't do that in a conscious way, then the natural forces will take care of it for us in a cataclysm, and then we'll just have to continue to rebuild our societies. We need the effort from our best minds to be able to solve problems that we're facing right now for the whole of the human family. And, of course, if we really want to, you know, if we really want to, you know, work up to our potential as being the caretakers of this planet, we have to pay more attention to the planet. And the disruption that we're causing and the discontinuities that our civilization is causing with the organic rhythms and processes of, you know, the sky and the water and the seasons and the earth and the soil, all of these things, we need to really have we need to take stock of them as a human race. We need to start asking the bigger questions. Nothing more, when you get a poisonous cloud of radioactivity circling the planet or destroying the oceans, it really does motivate people to start asking the larger questions, the questions that go beyond national boundaries and into the realm of the earth, the whole province of the earth, one earth, one people. These are opportunities, and they're not very, you know, pleasant opportunities, but they're opportunities for us to begin asking really important questions about who we are, what we value, and where do we want to go with it.
It seems that a big part of that is getting a recognition, getting a breath, getting some clarity with where we are and what we're doing. That alone, where we are and what we're doing. Taking stock of that, because out of that comes quite a foundation of, well, you know, the depth of our experience and every resource. Perhaps those hidden tools are waiting for us there in the depths of our experience. We tend to be so distracted. I mean, how do we even begin to focus on a problem, defining a problem, becoming conscious of any problem and potential solutions if we're not paying attention to what we're up to, where we are, and what we're doing? And it's funny, because Rudolf Steiner said that, and it was about 100 years ago he was talking about all this, and he said, with respect to our thinking, it is as though we are barely awake. This is humanity in general. And with respect to our sensing, our feeling, our sense of awareness, even just our bodily awareness, it is as though we are asleep but dreaming. But he said, with respect to our volition, our choices, will, our conscious will, he says, is as though we are completely dead asleep. Now, that was 100 years ago. And some of that has undoubtedly begun to change and shift, but not all of it. And I would wager that on the whole, most of the time, we're still pretty unconscious about our choices, what we're up to, what we're actually doing with our lives, with our attention, with our consciousness, day to day to day. We mostly go through the motions. We're pressed hard to try to keep our heads above the water. Literally.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point you make, Tony.
Well, so there may be some things that are right at our fingertips, right now, right in the midst of where we are, what's happening, what's going on, and what we're doing, that already could be great gifts, great boons. And perhaps, you know, there's a process that we're undoubtedly in the midst of that's trying to help open our awareness, our attention, to the bigger picture and the deeper story about what's going on here.
I think we have a real possibility that some breakthrough scientific advancements are going to occur. Breakthrough discoveries are going to occur shortly to help ameliorate some of the problems and situations that we're facing. And I think it's good that we give the support for the scientific community to do that, the really hands-on attention toward solving basic human needs. And I think that is really possible right now, as some of the stranglehold of the basic status quo organizational structures and governmental agencies, as that gets reformed, I think it's going to open up a space for new and innovative solutions to happen, and that could happen quite quickly, and we could have some very, very powerful, breakthroughs that, if not sidetracked or suppressed by certain interests, you know, and those allowed to come to fruition, could really help the human race in being able to make the adjustments that they need to make to stabilize the planet and to stabilize the impact of humans upon the Earth.
Well, I think it's starting to get very simple as well to discern something. There is a whole range of behavior and activity and synergy that leads to greater and greater destruction, greater and greater heartache, greater and greater grinding of life and knowing and joy, grinding it into, you know, bone meal. And then there's a whole other range of activity and behavior and synergy. And what that leads towards is a greater and greater thriving of existence, a greater, mm-hmm. Greater blooming of life, a greater knowing and experiencing, a deeper knowing and experiencing, and ultimately more joy, ecstasy, bliss.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stark. I mean, it's not hard. That's not a subtle distinction. Well, in some cases it may be, but on the whole, it's easy to point at the different. Now, and I'm not pointing a finger at any person or any group. I'm saying, look at this activity, because it's all the activity of humanity, and among all of the things that we do and all the things that we think that we are, there's quite a range of things. There's great, beautiful potentials that are being expressed, and there's great, horrific potentials that are being expressed in the way that we live and breathe and work with our circumstances. Seems that not being afraid, or at least being attentive and aware enough to see what's going on, how we support what's going on, and I think in the simplest sense, what type of thriving do we support? Do we support the thriving of destructive processes? Do we support war and mayhem? Do we support pollution and poisoning and dysfunction and sickness? Well, certainly we do. That's not all we do. We also, in some ways, support the blooming, the living, the thriving, the growing. But then it becomes, to me, a matter of attention. So how much of our activity and how much of our attending fosters and nurtures the strength and thriving of the life of our world? And how much of it, consciously or unconsciously, supports and bolsters the destructive? And that's a very, very, very simple thing, ultimately, to observe. And then the question becomes, what will we magnify? What will we give our attention to? And I'm not saying we should ignore and not try to do what we can do with the challenges that come before us. But I think ultimately what grows in our existence and in our experience is what we are blessing with our attention, what we do promote with our own eyes and ears and movement.
Yeah, and this Grand Cross that's coming July 1st of 2011. The Grand Cross will be all in cardinal signs. What we've had here for the last year or the last 8 months is we've had the energy's been in mutable signs and in the latter degrees of mutable signs, which means we've made a lot of mighty efforts to struggle with our inadequacies, our neuroses, and where we need to finish up, where we need to finish up our affairs and prepare ourselves to move assertively into the next cycle. The next cycle in cardinal signs is a very energetic cycle. And so what will happen is, even though it's a grand cross and all these different planets will be squaring each other, there'll be a lot of real legitimate energy being expressed at the same time. You might say that the karmic lesson involved here is to how to initiate, how to express, and how to reach out assertively in a way that's mutually beneficial for everybody but gets the job done. I think that could be, you could look at that as the challenge and the thing that we're going to be working on. Certainly won't be a boring time. It'll be a time that there'll be progress and turmoil and ferment in just about every department of our lives. But people, as you would see in what happened in Egypt, the removing the yoke of repression off of the backs of the Egyptians, and you could see the joy and the celebration of them being able to open up their fifth chakras, their voices, and to finally be heard, and to finally feel that they could express themselves, each individual in his own right, being able to make that scream of freedom, to make that demand, and not feeling that they had to cower in fear. So fear went out the door very quickly, and so now we have that kind of assertiveness that is present, and it will behoove us to allow that kind of exploration and assertiveness. It will behoove us to facilitate and to allow the proper soil to encourage those things to grow. And of course, in a democracy, when people feel they can speak up and be heard, you have a better democracy. Or if somebody has a good idea in business, they feel they can bring it forth, and they have the resources and the support, and can get the loans, then you can bring manufacturing back to America.
Well, and if we really believe in these ideas of democracy and competition, then why isn't the best way of approaching a relationship? Why aren't the best ways to come up with solutions, not just ideas, but the whole system and approach that we use to come up with solutions, our whole scientific and consciousness and approach to knowledge and experience? Why are not the best potential approaches being looked at? Now, there's only a really narrow range of approaches being looked at, and I think preparing that soil, like you're talking about, if it's really going to be fertile, if it's really going to make something grow, there has to be an openness and an availability to the very best fertilizer, the very best of organic catalysts that will help the life move. Because there's genius in our life, not just in us as individuals, but there's genius in the intelligence of our planet. There's genius in the expression and the intelligence of humanity as a whole, species as a whole, and the whole conglomerate together, how it works together in a healthy way, in a way that supports the mutual thriving of everything. So those potentials are what have been off the table. And although we all kind of work in our own ways to try to nurture good things, it's time for those kinds of options to start to become more dominant. The competition of great inspiration, of great practices, of great processes, and no longer an ideological debate and argument, but the actual allowing, the very best, not just ideas, but the very best synergy, the very best practical approach to start to emerge, to come forward. I think that's a good prayer for the equinox. I think if I had to offer one up, that would definitely be one.
Very good, Tony. And, when people begin to move out of their inertia and begin to take a risk and move beyond fear to be able to express what they feel in clear terms, then what happens is it ups the ante. For those people who are essentially manipulators and those who survive on covert tactics, when those people are called out by the people who are now fully embodied in their own expressiveness and their fearlessness, then what happens is that you have a system that becomes accountable and responsible to its members. And I think that's what we're going to be seeing. I think it'll be an interesting thing to see what happens in Wisconsin. I would be willing to predict that many of those people that did not honestly articulate their plans and were elected in November, when those people find that they have been recalled, by their bosses, the public, I think you'll see more restraint on the part of politicians when they see what the consequences are for dirty tricks and for manipulation. I think it'll be also interesting in Japan to see that if, in fact, these nuclear power plants are in really disrepair, and that how long it will take for them. Because, you see, government always says, well, the public is stupid, so we shouldn't tell them anything. We shouldn't tell them about extraterrestrial contacts. We shouldn't tell them about, you know, weapons of mass destruction. We shouldn't tell them about poisons. We shouldn't make it really uncomfortable for them because they can't handle the truth. I would suggest that idea that special interests and governments and the elites, the idea amongst those people that we can't take the truth, therefore we won't be told the truth, I think you're going to find that by the time this cycle is over, that will no longer be the case.
Well, and it seems to be real wisdom to recognize that secrecy is the beginning, official secrecy especially, but secrecy in general is the beginning of the destruction of freedom.
I agree with you on that.
It starts to happen as soon as we're allowed to subvert, like you were saying. You know, sometimes we convince ourselves that this is for our own good somehow, or we tell ourselves the story that it's for the good of everybody that's us too in our weakened state and in our humanness. We've been down that road.
Well, what happens in the end is that once you start telling lies and you begin your programs are all based on the postulate that people can't take the truth. So, but after a while it shifts. What happens is that you don't dare tell them the truth, because if they were to know the sum total of all the truth and were able to see how often they were manipulated and arrogantly treated, that what happens in the end is the cosmic accounting of that, what these could either be a revolution or these people being held to task for their systematic lying and deceptions. That's what in the end happens. I don't even think it begins. I don't think it has to do anything more. I mean, it's just arrogance, and arrogance, and condescension. But ultimately, what happens is the people that are pulling the strings and withholding the truth, they're afraid of the reaction that will happen when the public finds out the truth. And you can see in some of these popular uprisings just exactly where that passion goes when it's unleashed. So, you know, I would be very uncomfortable if I were some of the leaders around the planet that have systematically deceived the public and the world about what's actually going on. For instance, if we find out that there's been technologies that we've basically been given through agreements and exchanges by extraterrestrial people that could solve all the problems that we have on the planet. In other words, there's a perpetual motion machine out there that doesn't use nuclear fuel, but could be utilized in every home on the planet to generate infinite amount of power for all the needs that we... And people find out about that. And they find out that that machine and that capability has been there already for 20 or 30 years. You know that heads are going to roll. Just that one example there. You know that there's going to be such tremendous pushback.
Well, you know, what's stunning is that... apparently, there is a device like that. I may have even shown you some things about it. The John Searle, in particular, he's in his 80s, and he's developed a machine that somehow harnesses the energy of the background. It picks up on these Earth energies. These coils in this electromagnetic device, and it picks up on the rotating, counter-rotating fields. They're like vortices, and it just picks up on those, and they go incredibly fast, and there's no resistance because the coils themselves are suspended in a magnetic field. You have to expend the energy to create the magnetic field, basically, to levitate the coils, and then the energy takes over. And I've seen demonstrations of this thing. I don't understand it. I'm not an electrical engineer. But apparently, there's already practical devices that can be harnessed right now. We have them. Now, the question is, okay, so to me, it's a question of attention. Now, we know where we've been placing our attention. And, you know, it doesn't help us to point every finger in every direction about why that's the case. But the question becomes, well, why on earth might we not attend to something a little different now? Maybe it's time to start to look at something more, to start to consider wider possibilities, to start to think about things outside the box, outside the narrow range of answers and agreed ideas, you know, consensus reality,
mm-hmm.
that we've had in front of our faces. There are, apparently, right now, there are other solutions available. Things that we could actually, with some study and some diligence and a little bit of expense, we could build one of these devices for ourselves. And this guy's been building these things since the 1950s, literally. He's been building them since the 50s. So,
and here's the question. What's the difference between suppressing people's expression of their needs and suppressing the tangible device or knowledge that would also solve their needs? What's the difference? I think it comes from the same place. It comes from the same place.
Well,
and when as people open up their demand to be seen and taken into account, that also opens up the space for the pragmatic and empirical needs to be solved.
Well, you know, we know all too well, too. I know personally myself, and I know you would probably agree with this, and I know you so well. Things don't happen until we're ready. The real answer, the real insight, the real process, the real experience, it happens when there's real readiness, a real receptivity for what's going on, a real openness, surrender. We get to the point where we're willing to let go of everything that we'd held to that prevented us from seeing it. Now, perhaps we are just entering into, perhaps the answers are very much already with us on different levels, but perhaps it has to do with what we're ready to behold. And, you know, maybe whether we feel ready or not, circumstances will bring us to the point of needing to be ready. And it looks like we're approaching that. And that's what this equinox, I think, is too. It's bringing us to this point of being ready, recognizing our readiness, or maybe just being shocked by what's going on with us, by witnessing the actual reality of what we're really experiencing, good and bad, joyful and difficult, you know, heartbreaking and ecstatic. There's quite an array of real experience that's going on right now. And what I feel and suspect is that we're going to start to find our answers in the midst of that experience. Because it was only all our limited ideas that kept us from experiencing what was really going on in the first place. So going to the experience is a big part of it, because you have to leave those ideas behind, all those things that we suppose may be true.
I think we're going to have to wrap it up there for tonight. That was a discussion between myself and Tiger Windwalker that happened just last night. And we laid out there some of the observations that we've been both making about the celestial alignments relative to the solstice, or sorry, the equinox. The equinox is coming up this weekend. We'll have a full moon on Saturday, and then the equinox on Sunday, and equinox sun will be together with Uranus. So it's a pretty amazing series of alignments. And then what follows, what's coming in the coming months, is also equally amazing. So I'm wishing you the very best for the weekend. Enjoy the equinox. And if you're inclined to come join us on the at the event over at the Divine Science Community Center, send me an email and I'll provide some details for you. You'll also be able to find out more about these things and a recording of this event at my website, New Consciousness Rising. The address is ncrising.com. When you get there, click on the radio program link near the top of the page, and that will take you there, and you'll see the shows in chronological order. All right, thanks so much for listening. God bless you. See you next week.